Well, good evening, and thank you for being here, and to Elliott Bay for organizing this event. Seattle, home of the initial thrust in 1999 against corporate neoliberalism. And it's a lot of the work that really started right in this community that has reverberated around the world, so thank you very much. Well, we're going to have a conversation and perhaps punctuated with some readings by Arundhati Roy. And I must confess, I'm a little bit nervous to be doing this, even
He's
though
He's lying. Wow. It's just an act, David. But, I'm nervous.
I'm nervous because typically we meet and do interviews in the back seats of cars. Our first interview was, in fact, from Amherst to Logan Airport in Boston. It was very, very nerve-wracking to be trying to control the tape recorder as well as my notes flying all over the place and trying to keep a coherent interview going. But be that as it may, here we are, and it's wonderful to be here. I'd like to start, actually, with a quote from a recent interview I did with Arundhati Roy that's published in the International Socialist Review, the July-August issue, which I believe is available here. And the quote was about what the real fight is. And Arundhati said, it's that we're up against an economic system that is suffocating the majority of the people in this world. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to address it? So I thought that would be a really easy way to get into the evening. What are we going to do about it, and how are we going to address it?
That's not fair. Anyway, I think one of the things that we have to understand, and I think in particular here in America, I've just been here for 3 days now and obviously have, felt the electricity in the air about the coming elections. And just, in May, we had a very important election in India. And I think one of the dangers that we face is that it all becomes about personalities, and we forget that the system is in place, and it doesn't matter all that much who's piloting the machine, So as I was saying last night when I spoke at the ASA, that this whole fierce debate about the Democrats and the Republicans and whether Bush or Kerry is better, it's like, in fact, being asked to choose a detergent, whether you choose Tide or Ivory Snow, they're both owned by Procter & Gamble. And so, first of all, we have to understand, and I know that all of you do understand that, elections are just an apparent choice now. In India, we were faced with outright fascism, with the BJP, and sort of covert communalism that the Congress Party had indulged in for 50 years, preparing the ground in many ways for the right wing. It was a Congress Party that actually opened India's markets to corporate globalization. But the one difference was that at least in their election campaign, at least they had to lie. At least they had to say that they were against their old policies. But here, they don't even do you the dignity of that, The Democrats are not even pretending that they are against the war or against the occupation, And And that, I think, is very important because the anti-war movement in America has been so phenomenal, a service not just to Americans, but to all of us in the world. And you can't allow them to hijack your beliefs and put your weight behind somebody who's openly saying that he believes in the occupation, that he would have attacked Iraq even if he had known there were no weapons of mass destruction, that he will actually get UN cover for the occupation, that he will try and get Indian and Pakistani soldiers to go and die in Iraq instead, and that the Germans and the French and the Russians might be able to share in the spoils of the occupation. You know, is that better or worse for somebody who lives in the subject nations of empire? And the fact is that we all know that what is happening is that there is a system of economic disparity that is being entrenched in the world today. It isn't an accident. It isn't an accident that, you know, 580 billionaires in the world have greater income than, I think the figure is 170 of the poorest countries, something like that. I don't know, I don't quite remember the figures, but the fact is that the disparities in the world are huge, and the disparities are not between rich countries and poor countries, but between rich people and poor people. So what do we do about it? We understand a few things. One is that the system of electoral democracy as it stands today is premised on a religious acceptance of the nation state. But the system of corporate globalization is not. The system of corporate globalization is premised on the fact that liquid capital can move through poor countries at an enormous scale, dictating the agendas, forcing them to, dictating economic policy in those countries by insinuating itself into those economies. And that capital requires the coercive powers of the nation state to contain the revolt in the servants' quarters, but it ensures that individual countries cannot stand up to the project of corporate globalization, which is why you have even people like Lula of Brazil or Mandela of South Africa who were giants in the opposition, but reduced to dwarves on the global stage, blackmailed by the threat of capital flight. So theoretically, the only way to confront this is what all of us are involved in, which is the globalization of dissent, which is the joining of hands of people who do not believe in empire. We have to join hands across countries and across continents in very specific ways and stop this, because it isn't inevitable, globalization. It is signed by specific contracts with specific signatures and specific governments and specific companies. And we have to bring that to its knees.
Imperialism years ago was only the province of certain Marxist scholars. It was a very dirty word that couldn't be spoken in polite company. But today, you have people like Michael Ignatieff, who seems to have unlimited access to the New York Times Sunday Magazine cover stories, in article after article extolling the virtues of what he calls imperialism light. And you have someone like Salman Rushdie writing that what America did in Afghanistan did what it had to do and did it well. I'm wondering now, given 3 years since the attack on Afghanistan, with the reconstruction of the warlords, the huge surge in opium trafficking, the essentially reconstructing of the old regime, what your views are on Afghanistan?
Well, Afghanistan has just been thrown back to the warlords the way it was, you know, abandoned after the American government, you know, funded the Mujahideen in order to get the Russians out. And today, Hamid Karzai, the CIA man who worked for UNOCAL, can't even get, you know, his own security, can't even trust Afghans with his own security. That has to be private mercenaries, you know, just as everything else is being privatized now, security and torture and prison administration and all of this is being privatized. So what can you say, you know, to Michael Ignatieff? I mean, I think that, you know, I've grown up in India and I've lived all my life there, and I've never spent any time, any large amounts of time in the West. So when you come here and you listen to that talk, you think, but even our fascists are not saying that, you know? It's like I've often been asked to come and debate imperialism as the lesser evil. And I think, look, it's like asking me about the pros and cons of child abuse or something. Is it a subject that I should debate, you know? It's like, you know, every little by-lane that we walk down in India, are people saying, bring them back. We miss it so badly. But, so it's a kind of new racism, and it isn't even all that new, so we can't even give them points for originality on this. You know, these debates have taken place in the colonial time in almost exactly the same words, you know, civilizing the savages and the whole missionary thing and all of that. So that isn't even something that I really don't think it's even worth the dignity of a debate, you know. It is just an aspect of power. It is what power always will say. And we can't even allow it to deflect our attention for 6 seconds.
I think it was in that backseat interview that you recalled when you were growing up as a kid in Kerala during the 1960s that you wondered whether you would be considered a dink or a gook or a slope. And today, the language, of course, is raghead and towelhead and haji and Alibabas.
Yeah, because Kerala was very much like Vietnam. You know, we too had rice fields and rivers and communists. We were just a few thousand miles west of Vietnam. So I do remember wondering whether we would be gooks and, you know, blown out of the bushes while you had some Hollywood background score playing. But yeah, nothing's changed all that much, except that it's gone back to the workshop and come out with its edges rounded. In fact, I might read the this year at the World Social Forum, the talk I gave was called "Do Turkeys Enjoy Thanksgiving?" And and there's a small passage in it which I'll read to you, which sort of talks about new imperialism. Like old imperialism, new imperialism too relies for its success on a network of agents, corrupt local elites who service empire. But unlike in the old days, the new imperialist doesn't need to trudge around the tropics risking malaria or diarrhea or early death. New imperialism can be conducted on email. The vulgar hands-on racism of old imperialism is outdated. The cornerstone of new imperialism is new racism. The tradition of turkey pardoning in the United States is a wonderful allegory for new racism. Every year since 1947, the National Turkey Federation has presented the U.S. president with a turkey for Thanksgiving. Every year, in a show of ceremonial magnanimity, the president spares that particular bird and eats another one. After receiving the presidential pardon, the chosen one is sent to Frying Pan Park in Virginia to live out its natural life. The rest of the 50 million turkeys raised for Thanksgiving are slaughtered and eaten on Thanksgiving Day. ConAgra Foods, the company that has won the presidential turkey contract, says that it trains the lucky birds to be sociable, to interact with dignitaries, school children, and the press. Soon, they'll even speak English. That's how new racism in the corporate era works. A few carefully bred turkeys, the local elites of various countries, a community of wealthy immigrants, investment bankers, the occasional Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice, some singers, some writers like myself, are given absolution and a pass to Frying Pan Park. The remaining millions lose their jobs, are evicted from their homes, have their water and electricity connections cut, and die of AIDS. Basically, they're for the pot. But the fortunate fowls in Frying Pan Park are doing fine. Some of them even work for the IMF and the WTO. So who can accuse these organizations of being anti-Turkey? Some serve as board members on the Turkey Choosing Committee. So who can say that turkeys are against Thanksgiving? They participate in it. Who can say that the poor are anti-corporate globalization? There's a stampede to get into Frying Pan Park. So what if most perish on the way? As a part of the project of new racism, we also have new genocide. New genocide in this new era of economic interdependence can be facilitated by economic sanctions. New genocide means creating conditions that lead to mass death without actually going out and killing people. Dennis Halliday, who was the UN humanitarian coordinator in Iraq between 1997 and 1998, after which he resigned in disgust, used the term genocide to describe the sanctions in Iraq. In Iraq, the sanctions outdid Saddam Hussein's best efforts by claiming more than 500,000 children's lives. In the new era, apartheid as formal policy is generally considered antiquated and unnecessary. International instruments of trade and finance oversee a complex system of multilateral trade law and financial agreements that keep the poor in their Bantustans anyway. Its whole purpose is to institutionalize inequity. Why else would it be that the United States taxes a garment made by a Bangladeshi manufacturer 20 times more than it taxes a garment made in the United Kingdom? Why else would it be that countries that now grow 90% of the world's cocoa bean produce only 5% of the world's chocolate? Why else would it be that countries that grow cocoa bean like the Ivory Coast and Ghana are taxed out of the market if they try and turn it into chocolate? Why else would it be that rich countries that spend over $1 billion a day on subsidies to farmers demand that poor countries like India withdraw all agricultural subsidies, including subsidized electricity? Why else would it be that after having been plundered by colonizing regimes for more than half a century, former colonies are steeped in debt to those same regimes and repay them some $382 billion a year?
Colonies went out of fashion several decades ago, but with the U.S. occupation and colonization of Iraq, you're calling for something rather dramatic in terms of what the U.S. should do.
Not dramatic, just reasonable, that they should pull out and pay reparations.
Yeah. But the maddened king, as you call W. Bush, says that the world is a safer place. Do you feel safer in India now that Saddam Hussein is no longer in power in Iraq?
Well, I really miss those amazing technicolor terror alerts in India. You know, the polka dotted and salmon pink and orange and lavender and whatever, you know. So the fact is, of course, that, I mean, all of you know this, but here, you know, in India, especially, I mean, I'm not talking about the elite, but among normal people, there is a distinction between the government and the people, between the Sarkar, as we call it, and the public. But here, this whole regime of synthetically manufactured fear has bonded people to the government, and that bond is not because of public health care or looking after the old or education or anything, social services, but fear. And I think it would be a disaster for the American government if all of you started feeling safe, you know? I mean, if you look at, say, India, in the last, since 1989 to today, of course, the Indian corporate press is no different from the American corporate press. The only, you know, in a twisted sense, the only lucky thing is that most people can't read it. So, you know, they don't get, the lies and the indoctrination don't penetrate very deep. But if you did read it, would you possibly believe that in the last 14 years, 80,000 people have been killed in Kashmir? Every day there are terrorist attacks. In states like Andhra Pradesh, 200 extremists are killed every year. Every day, you know, there are militant strikes. But none of us go around feeling terrified. You know, all of us have just, we all know that, you know, everybody has to just continue living as they do, and people would laugh at the government if they started this technicolor terror alert thing, because everyone has so many other problems, you know. So I think not to be frightened here is a political act, you know. Just
Talking about the media in the checkbook and the cruise missile, you say that Americans live in a bubble of lots of advertisements and no information. What advice could you give people in terms of breaking through the bubble?
Well, you know, I think we need to think about what is it that the mass media is doing to us, you know? And, you know, people who live outside America sometimes find it hard to actually believe the levels of indoctrination that do take place through it. And because somehow in a more anarchic society, which is the society which I live in, you can't indoctrinate it. You know, I mean, one day you have the Kumbh Mela with, you know, millions of people, and Naga sadhus are trying to tow the district collector's car with their penis, and you can't tell him that corporate globalization is the answer to your problems, you know? Drink more Coke. So sometimes it's hard for us to understand the reach and penetration of television and newspapers here. But I think one of the mistakes a lot of us as activists make is in railing against it to a point where we don't know what to do with it. And I think that there are two things. One is that you do have very strong alternate media as well. I mean, David of Alternate Radio is sitting here. You have Democracy Now. You have the internet. There is so much going on, so many places to look for other information. But also, I think there's a kind of ad busting to be done, which is you read the mainstream media, but what you gather from it is not what they want to tell you. It's like you have to learn to decode it, to understand it for the boardroom bulletin that it is. And therefore, you use its power against itself. And I think that's very important to do, because many of us make the mistake of thinking that the corporate media supports the neoliberal project. It doesn't. It is the neoliberal project. That's what it is, you know. So you just see it so blatantly now. It's become so blatant, and in America, just think of yourselves in 2001, what was going on in this country, and think of what is going on now. What a huge victory so many of you have won in terms of being this flag-waving, frightening place. You know, I remember in 2002 when I spoke in Porto Alegre, I didn't even frankly believe what I was saying at that time. It was just wishful thinking. And there in Brazil, I said, you know, activists and musicians and writers and so many people have worked together to strip empire of its sheen, and we've exposed it, and now it stands too ugly to behold itself in the mirror. That much I believed. And the next sentence was, soon it will not be able to rally its own people. And look what's happened. It's happening here, and it's because of you, you know. So between that time and now, what used to be America's secret history is now street talk. And that's because of you. And it's such a brilliant job. And you just mustn't lose focus. You mustn't start thinking that now, if Kerry comes to power, we can all go back home and be happy.
The global demonstrations against the Iraq war on February 15, 2003 turned out at least 10 million, some accounts up to 15, 20 million people around the world. You've called that one of the greatest affirmations of the human spirit and morality. But then the war started. They got what they wanted, and people went home.
Well, you know, I think this is something we have to ask ourselves about. Because the first part of this question is that you did have this incredible display of public morality. In no European country was the support for a unilateral war more than 11%. Thousands, hundreds of thousands marched on the streets of America. And still, these supposedly democratic countries went to war. So the question is democracy still democratic? You know, A. B, are governments accountable to the people who elected them? And C, are people responsible in democratic countries for the actions of their governments? It's a very serious crisis that is facing democracies today. And if you get caught in this, you know, ivory snow versus tide debate, if you get caught in having to choose between a detergent with oxy boosters or gentle cleansers, we're finished, you know. So the point is, how do you keep power on a short leash? How do you make it accountable? And the fact is that we can't also only feel good about what we do. What we have done has been fantastic, but we must accept that it's not enough. And one of the problems is that symbolic resistance has unmoored itself from real civil disobedience, you know? And that is very dangerous, because governments have learned how to wait these things out, You know, and they think we're like children with rattles in the crib, you know, just let them get on with their weekend demonstration and we just carry on with what we have to do. Public opinion is so fickle and so on. And the thing is that the symbolic aspect of resistance is very important. The theater is very important, but not at the cost of real civil disobedience. You know, so we have to find ways of implementing what we are saying seriously. And you look at what's happening today. I feel that the Iraqi resistance is fighting on the front lines of empire. It's all right. We know that it's full, you know, that it's a motley group of former Baathists and fed up collaborationists and communists and all kinds of people. But no resistance movement is pristine. And if we are going to only invest our purity in pristine movements, you know, we may as well forget it. And the point is, this is our resistance, and we have to support it. And you have to understand that the American soldiers who are dying in Iraq, they are conscripts of a poverty draft. You all know that from the poorest parts of America being sent to war. In fact, they as well as the Iraqis are victims of the same horrendous system that asks for their lives in return for a victory that will never be theirs. And the other thing is that, look, the book that David and I did together is called The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile. And the fact is that sometimes the cruise missile is highlighted and you're thinking about the torture and the invasion and the army and the people dying and so on. But meanwhile, the contracts are being signed, the pipelines are being laid. You know, everything is being put in place for the time when they can withdraw the cruise missile, but the system of appropriation is already in place. And you have these companies like Bechtel and Halliburton who did business with Saddam Hussein, who were on the Iraq Liberation Board or whatever it was called, you know, who are now, you know, profiting in the billions from the destruction and the reconstruction of Iraq. And those same companies were in Cochabamba, in privatization. Those same companies are in India, along with Enron, you know, Enron and Bechtel, for instance, were involved in the first private power project in India, where the profits were 60% of India's entire rural development budget, you know. So the point I'm trying to make is, here is Iraq on the front lines of this war on empire, but each of these companies that are involved in this place have economic outposts across the world. So it gives us a foothold. It gives us a way of using our disparity but making it all bear down on single individual corporations and companies. And if we can't shut them down, if we can't prevent them from doing what they're doing, then how can we call ourselves a resistance? You know, we have to do it. We have to find a way of doing it. And the thing is, it's not going to happen without us paying a price. It's not going to happen in our overtime or on weekends or anything like that, you know? People in poor countries are being battered by the system. It's not only that empire arrives in their lives as it has arrived in Iraq. It also arrives in the form of exorbitant electricity bills that they can't pay, of water cutoffs, of being dismissed from their jobs and uprooted from their lands. I was in South Africa just, you know, in June, and just 4 days before I left, I was in this black township called Phoenix, where the police and the municipal police arrived in the township to disconnect illegal electricity connections, because electricity has been privatized there and the poor have just been disconnected, millions of them. So they just reconnect, you know, illegally. So these police went and, you know, removed all the cables, and an old lady went out and said, look, it's all right, remove the cables, but just wait here, I want the press to come. And I want to explain to them why we need to steal electricity. So they started pushing her around, and this young boy who was her son, 18-year-old boy, came out and said, look, that's my mother you're pushing around. And they just put a gun to his head and shot him. You know, and so empire is overseen by the repressive machinery of the states that it's in, you know, the government, the police, the army, the bureaucracy. If you look at a country like India, we are old hands at the game. You know, you have the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which allows a non-commissioned army officer to kill anybody on suspicion of creating public disturbance. All over the Northeast, all over Kashmir, you have the Gangster Act, you have the Special Area Security Act, you have the Terrorist and Disruptive Areas Act, which is now lapsed, but still people are being tried under. And then you have the equivalent of Patriot, which is POTA, where thousands of people are just being picked up and held without trial. And their crime is poverty. It isn't that they're terrorists. They're being called terrorists, but their crime is poverty. So poverty and terrorism are being conflated, and states are becoming very sophisticated in their repression. And how do we counter that? You know, these are so this battle is not going to be won without us paying a price. You know, that's one thing we have to understand. It's not going to be a cute war.
That POTA that you mentioned, the Protection of Terrorism Act, Prevention of Terrorism Act, I believe you called the Production of Terrorism Act, has its counterpart in the United States in the Patriot Act, which has greatly enhanced the ability of the state to surveil and imprison its citizens.
And the thing is, you know, I think fundamentally, the thing about these acts that we have to understand is that they are not meant for the terrorists, because the terrorists are just shot or taken, in the case of America, to Guantanamo Bay, or suspected terrorists. Those acts are meant to terrorize you. Those acts are meant to terrorize. You know, so basically all of us stand accused. It prepares the ground for the government to make all of us culprits and then pick off whichever one of us it wants to. So, and of course we know that once we give up these freedoms, will we ever get them back? And how can it be? Look, like in India, at least when the Congress party was campaigning, one of the main issues was that it was going to withdraw POTA, the Prevention of Terrorism Act. It said it was going to withdraw POTA. It probably will, but not before it puts into legislation other kinds of legislation that approximate it, you know, so it won't be POTA, it'll be MOTA or whatever. But here, are they even saying that they'll repeal it? It's an insult to you, you know, that they don't even think they have to say it. You know, is it populist to say we are going to deal in sterner ways with terror and we're going to make America stronger and safer and more oxy boosters? And it's a crazy situation that they don't even, I mean, no, I know a lot of people say that, oh, you know, Kerry is saying this, but when he comes to power, he'll be different. But no, nobody moves to the left after they come to power. They move only to the right.
One of essays in your new collection, An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire, is called When the Saints Go Marching Out. Mohandas, which is the name of Mahatma Gandhi, Mandela, and Martin, the three M's. Let's talk a little bit about Gandhi, because he seems to have been able to devise strategies where he was able to exploit cracks in the empire.
Well, you know, I think that Gandhi was one of the brightest, most cunning and imaginative politicians of the modern age. You know, what he did was what great writers do, that he, you know, great writers expand the human imagination. Gandhi expanded the political imagination. But, of course, we mustn't ever think that the Indian freedom struggle was a revolutionary struggle. It wasn't. Because the Indian elite stepped very easily into the shoes of the British imperialists. You know, and nor was it only a non-violent struggle, because that's the other myth, you know, that it was an entirely non-violent struggle. It wasn't. But what Gandhi did, I think, was that he... This was democratic, you know, because of the ways in which he devised strategy. It included a lot of people. He found ways of including masses of people. For instance, in 1931, when they did the Dandi March, where they decided to march to the coast, 21 days, I think, they marched to the coast to make salt in order to break the British salt tax laws, which prevented Indians from making salt. It was symbolic, but also then millions of Indians began to make salt, and it struck at the economic underpinning of empire. So that was his brilliance, you know. But I think we really need to reimagine nonviolent resistance, because there isn't any debate taking place that is more important in the world today than the strategies of resistance. And whatever, and there can never be one strategy, you know, like everybody's never going to agree about one strategy, you know. It can't be that while we watch the American war machine occupy Iraq, torture its prisoners, appropriate its resources, we are waiting for this pristine, secular, democratic, nonviolent, feminist resistance to come along, you know. So we can't prescribe to the Iraqis how to conduct their resistance, but we have to shore up our end of it by forcing America and its allies to leave Iraq now.
I think a lot of people here have on their mind the November 2nd election and what to do, who to vote for. Tariq Ali, who's very critical of Kerry, recently said, if the American population were to vote Bush out of office, it would have a tremendous impact on world opinion. Our option at the moment is limited. Do we defeat a warmonger government or not? What do you think of Ali's perspective on that?
Look, it's a very, very complicated and difficult debate in which I think there are two things you can do. You can act expediently if you like, but you must speak on principle. And I cannot sit here with any kind of honesty and say to you that I support Kerry. I cannot do that. You know, it's I'll tell you a small example. In India, you may not be aware of the levels of violence and jingoism and fascism that we faced over the last 5 years. In Gujarat, rampaging mobs murdered, raped, gang raped, burnt alive 2,000 Muslims on the streets drove 150,000 out of their homes. Gujarat is this western state. Then you have Rajasthan, you have Maharashtra, you have Madhya Pradesh, and you have this, you know, this kind of plague of Hindu fascism spreading. And you had a central government which was supported by the BJP. Now, a lot of the people that I work with and know work in the state of Madhya Pradesh, central India, where there was a Congress state government for 10 years. This government had overseen the building of these many dams on the Narmada Valley. It had overseen the privatization of electricity, of water, the driving out from their homes and lands of hundreds of thousands of people. The disconnection of single point electricity connections because they signed these huge contracts for privatization with the Asian Development Bank. Now, the activists in these areas knew that a lot of the reason the Congress was also so boldly doing these things was it was saying, what option do you have? Are you going to get the BJP? Are you going to campaign for the BJP? Are you going to open yourself up not just to being physically beaten, but maybe even killed? You know? But I want to tell you that they didn't campaign for the Congress. They didn't. You know, they just said, we do not believe in this. And we are going to continue to do our work. And we're outside. I mean, it was such a horrendous situation because the BJP was pretending to be anti-reform, saying we'll stop this, we'll change that. They did come to power, the BJP. And within 10 days, they were on the dam site saying we're going to build the dam. You know, so people are waiting for their houses to get submerged. This was the dilemma. But the point is then, you have to say, look, I'm not going to... I mean, can you actually campaign for a man who's saying that I'm going to send more troops to Iraq? How? You know? So I think it's very important for us to remain principled. I mean, let me tell you that during the Indian elections, people used to keep asking me this, aren't you campaigning for the Congress? Aren't you campaigning for the Congress? Because, of course, I had spent the last 5 years denouncing the BJP. I said, how can I campaign for the Congress that also oversaw the carnage of Sikhs in Delhi in 1984, that opened the markets to neoliberalism in the early 90s? And every time you're put under this pressure, I said, you know, I feel sometimes when I'm asked this question, like I imagine that a gay person must feel when they're watching straight sex, you know, that I'm sort of interested but not involved, you know. And you have to, I think it's very important for us to understand that we are people of principle. And we are soldiers who are fighting a different battle, and we cannot be co-opted into this. So you got to refuse the terms of this debate, otherwise you're co-opted. You know, you have. I'm not going to say who you should vote for. I'm not going to sit here and tell you vote for this one, vote for that one, because we are also people, all of us here are people of influence and power, and we can't allow our power to be co-opted by those people. We cannot.
We talked about independent media a little earlier. I should mention Elliott Bay and this hall and Southend Press, one of the best independent presses in the country, are examples of that. Yeah. And here in Seattle, the Indie Media Center, a tremendously historically important development and innovation. So wherever possible, we need to grow independent media, we need to nurture it, and we need to sustain it. So please do whatever you can to support these institutions. While we're trying to, you know, penetrate the corporate media, we're also trying to build parallel structures. And your support is absolutely critical, particularly when we're talking about independent bookstores in an age of, you know, borderization and Barnes and Noblization of the countryside.
But I just want to say, coming back to this subject of the American election, that you have to force the Democrats to say that they're against the war, otherwise you're not going to support them. You know? You know, they can't tell you what to do. They're the servants of public servants. You got to tell them what to do.
I wonder if you have any ideas about reaching beyond the choir, as it were. One of the frequent charges that's, you know, leveled against the left or progressive people is that, you know, we talk among ourselves, we have a good time, and everyone nods their head and, you know, has a beer and then goes home and nothing happens. I mean, there's some truth to that. How do we get to a larger audience?
Well, I think first of all, I don't get that feeling from where I come, you know, because what we are saying is what a majority of India's poor are saying, you know. So there's no question of preaching to the choir there. It's just that the choir doesn't. The millions of people don't have a voice. You know, that's a different matter. But it isn't ghettoized thinking at all. If it were, then we would be politically wrong, don't you think? Because we are saying that this is a view which is on the side of the world's poor. So I don't think I accept that charge, that we just have a good time and have a beer and go to bed. I don't know, I don't, but I don't know how it is here. But I think on another level, it is true that there is a sort of suspicion of success or popularity among left intellectuals, you know. You like to have this language which is sort of impenetrable and, you know, not quite as bad as the postmodernists, but getting there, you know. So I think it's very important to know that Fox News' success is our failure, you know. So one of the things that I really try and do anyway is to snatch our futures back from the world of experts. You know, to say, I'm sorry, but it's not that hard to understand and it's not that hard to explain. And to do that, to tell the story, to join the dots, to make this, and if you think of it, just, you know, just a few years ago, you know, just before, I must say that when the confrontation happened in Seattle at the WTO convention, for many of us in the subject nations of empire, it was a delightful thing to know that even people in imperialist countries shared our battles. It was really the beginnings of the globalization of dissent. But I think we do need to, and we have to a great extent. I mean, corporate globalization wasn't something that was palpable earlier. Nobody really knew what it meant. The enemy wasn't corporeal, but it is now. And that is because of the efforts of so many people. I mean, now you go into any bookshop in America and look at the books there and think 7, 8, 9 years ago, would they have been there? No. And that's what we've done, you know, and must continue to do. I think even, say, documentary filmmaking, and I'm not only talking about the high end of it, you know, I'm not only talking about 9/11, but the fact is that technology has enabled documentary film to become such a powerful tool, both to the right and to the left. But the fact is, in countries like India, it's become such an important political weapon that governments are really frightened how to censor it, how to stop it, how to make sure these filmmakers who used to need grants from the Ford Foundation and from some, you know, state film corporation now can just, you know, go and do it on their own with a little camera. And those films are so subversive and so gripping. You know, you go to a little village in India with a projector and a camera and show films, and thousands of people will come. So these are new tools that are being honed and that are actually, I think I wrote an essay about it. You call the buffalo and the bees, you know, like the mainstream corporate media is like this buffalo. And the alternate media is like this swarm of bees around the buffalo. And it's like contextualizing the buffalo. It's like a CD-ROM. The buffalo is the main text and the bees are all, you click and you get the inside story. And, you know, that kind of thing, the buffalo still sort of sets the agenda. But the bees are doing a pretty good job right now. And we have to just continue that in some way.
Now, Michael Moore has been very successful in terms of reaching a much larger audience. In fact, he has two books on the bestseller list right now, and certainly Fahrenheit 9/11 has been seen by millions and millions of people, and it will be out on DVD, I believe, in a few weeks. What can we learn from those kinds of interventions?
Well, the obvious, I think. You know, that those kind of interventions have a space now and have to be exploited because it blows open, you know, spaces. It changes what people expect from cinema, makes it all so much more exciting. I think there are other films like Control Room and, you know, films which
Jahan Mujem, Egyptian-American filmmaker.
Yeah, I think it's kind of everything has to become out of control now. You know, we've just got to become really bad.
A couple of years ago, you were at the United World College in a small town in northern New Mexico, Las Vegas, New Mexico. And you were talking to the students there, and I took these notes down.
You said,
I follow you around. You know? Yeah. It's difficult to be citizens of an empire because it's hard to listen. Put your ear to the wall, listen to the whisper. If you put your ear to the wall now, what would you hear?
Hear?
Yeah.
I don't feel qualified to answer that properly, you know, because I think I've just been here for 3 or 4 days now and speaking in places like this where, you know, it's not exactly like I'm on the street listening to things. So, but I must say that when I first wrote an essay, you know, soon after September 11th, I wrote an essay called The Algebra of Infinite Justice. And when I wrote it, I did think to myself, you know, here is me writing this essay that's probably going to annoy this huge and powerful country, and that's the end of me. But then as a writer, if I can't write what I think, that would be the end of me anyway. So let me just do it. And instead, I find that, you know, it's just so wonderful to arrive here and to know that you all are here. You know, it gives so much strength to people. And I'm always called, of course, you know, for strategic reasons, anti-American. And I'm so far from being anti-American. It's not funny because I have such a deep respect for what you do. You know, I can assure you that if India and Pakistan were at war, it would be hard for me to find people to come out. I mean, not for me, for any of us to find people to come out in the numbers in which you have come out and protested against what your government is doing. So, you know, power to you. That's just fantastic what you do. And it is something which encourages people everywhere. You know, that it blurs these national borders, you know. You're this, I'm that, you know. You don't even talk like this. You're an American and I'm an Indian and so-and-so is a Moroccan. And, you know, you're finding a different kind of language in which to talk. We are finding different kind of language in which to talk to each other, which is important. But I do think that, I said this just now, but I'll say it again, that this idea that America's secret history is street talk is what I hear, you know, that is all out in the open now. And the fact is that empires always overreach themselves and then crumble. And, it, you know, power has a short shelf life.
Kathy Kelly is an extraordinary woman. She's one of the founders of Voices in the Wilderness. She just served a four-month sentence in jail for civil disobedience at the School of the Americas training camp in Fort Benning, Georgia. She says about, again, talking about courage, she says it's the ability to control fear, and we catch courage from one another. Now, I know you've spent a lot of time with some very extraordinary women in the Narmada Valley. What kind of courage were you able to catch?
Well, I think, you know, one of the facts is that one of the great things about the nonviolent political resistance in India, its legacy, is that it really, you know, has women at the heart of it. It really allows women into the heart of it. And that, when movements become violent, then not only does the state react with huge coercive power, but that violence by people on your own side is very soon turned on women. So because we have this legacy, I think in places like the Narmada Valley, women also realize that they are far bigger victims than the men are. Say 100,000 people are being displaced by a dam, and they're not being given land for land because there's no land. The men are given some cash compensation. The men buy motorcycles or get drunk and then it's finished, you know, and the women are left in a terrible situation. So they are fighting this battle much more fiercely. And everywhere you go, you see that they're really at the forefront of it. You know, there's a wonderful incident in the Maheshwar submergence area where the government came, actually not the government, this private corporation is building the dam, came and dumped some 10 truckloads of stone on a particular farmer's land, you know, near the dam site. They hadn't acquired it or anything. So these 10,000 women went, picked up the stone and dumped it on the other side of the road and then marched to the collector's office and said, next time it'll be in your house. You know? So, but I think of all the women's, you know, resistances, the most remarkable today is Rawa in Afghanistan. You know, what a tremendous battle they have waged and continue to wage. And what a principled battle. You know, talk about Bush and Kerry. They were faced with the Taliban and the Northern Alliance and the Americans in between, you know. And we were made to feel that America was fighting a feminist war in Afghanistan. But look at their situation now. You know, they didn't say, yeah, we'll support you and come in, you know. At no point did they take an expedient position. And I think we have to learn from that.
RAWA being the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. In one of your essays in War Talk, you conclude with a famous quote from Shelley's Mask of Anarchy, "Ye be many, they be few." Talk about that.
Yeah, well, that is what is happening. I mean, it's in the nature of capitalism, isn't it? That the more profit you make, the more you plow back into the machine, the more profit you make. And so now you have a situation in which, like I said, 500 billionaires have more money than, you know, whole hundreds of countries put together, the GDP of hundreds of countries. And that rift is widening. I think today's paper said that the rift between the rich and the poor of America is widening. Everywhere that's happening. And the fact is that I believe that wars must be waged from positions of strength. You know, so the poor must fight from their position of strength, which is on the streets and in the mountains and the valleys and the of the world, not in boardrooms and parliaments and courts where they're just manipulated and left. So we are, I mean, the strength we have is actually the opposite of being a little club of people who make each other happy and drink beer and go back. I completely reject that, actually. I think we are on the side of the millions, and that is our strength, and we must recognize it and work with it, you know?
There is an alternative to terrorism. What is it?
Begins with J.
U. S.
Justice. Justice.
How do we get there? These are the easy questions. These are the easy questions.
These are the easy questions. Well, see, the point is that, you know, terrorism has been isolated and made to look like some kind of thing that has no past and has no future and is just some aberration of maniacs. It isn't. You know, of course, sometimes it is, but I've said this yesterday when I was speaking, that if you look at it, the logic that underlies terrorism and the logic that underlies the war on terror is the same. Both hold ordinary people responsible for the actions of governments, you know? And the fact is that, Osama bin Laden or the Al-Qaeda, in their attacks on September 11th, took the lives of many ordinary American people. And on the attack in Afghanistan and on Iraq, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghans paid for the actions of the Taliban or for the actions of Saddam Hussein. The difference is that the Afghans didn't elect the Taliban. The Iraqis didn't elect Saddam Hussein. You know, so how do we justify these kinds of wars? I really think that terrorism is the privatization of war. You know, they are the free marketeers. They are the free marketeers of war. They're the ones who say that they don't believe that violence, you know, legitimate violence is only the monopoly of the state. So we can't condemn terrorism unless we condemn the war on terror. And no government that does not show itself to be open to change by nonviolent dissent can actually condemn terrorism. You know, because if every avenue of nonviolent dissent is closed or mocked, or bought off or broken, then by default you privilege violence. When all your respect and admiration and research and media coverage and the whole economy is based on war and violence, when violence is deified, on what grounds are you going to condemn terrorism? You know, whatever people lack in wealth and power, they make up with stealth and strategy, you know. So we can't just be ridiculously every time we are asked to say something, say, oh, terrorism is a terrible thing, without talking about repression, without talking about justice, without talking about occupation, without talking about privatization, without talking about the fact that, you know, this country has its army strung across the globe. And then, of course, you know, there are other words that even how language has been co-opted. If you say democracy, actually it means neoliberalism. If you say reforms, it actually means repression. You know, everything has been turned into something else. So we even have to reclaim language now.
I think we're almost simulating Indian-like conditions in terms of the heat in here, and thank everyone for their patience with the climactic conditions. I know you want to read a piece from Ordinary Citizen's Person's Guide to Empire, but I'd just like to get this one quote in from Margaret Mead. Years ago, she said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has."
So this is just, last year I spoke at the Riverside Church, and the talk was called Instant Mix Imperial Democracy, Buy One, Get One Free. And this is just the end of it, which I'll read to you. "We might as well accept the fact that there is no conventional military force that can successfully challenge the American war machine. Terrorist strikes only give the U.S. government an opportunity that it's eagerly waiting for to further tighten its stranglehold. Within days of an attack, you can bet that Patriot 2 will be passed. To argue against U.S. military aggression by saying that it'll increase the possibilities of terrorist strike is futile. It's like threatening Brer Rabbit that you'll throw him into the bramble bush. Anyone who's read the document called The Project for the New American Century can attest to that. The U.S. government has already displayed in no uncertain terms the range and extent of its capability for paranoid aggression. In human psychology, paranoid aggression is usually an indicator of nervous insecurity. It could be argued that it's no different in the case of the psychology of nations. Empire is paranoid because it has a soft underbelly. Its homeland may be defended by border patrols and nuclear weapons, but its economy is strung out across the globe. Its economic outposts are exposed and vulnerable. Yet it would be naive to imagine that we can directly confront empire. Our strategy must be to isolate its working parts and disable them one by one. No target is too small, no victory too insignificant. We could reverse the idea of economic sanctions imposed on poor countries by empire and its allies. We could impose a regime of people sanctions on every corporate house that has been awarded a contract in post-war Iraq. That could be our response to the shock and awe campaign. It would be a great beginning. Another urgent challenge is to expose the corporate media for the boardroom bulletin that it really is. We need to create a universe of alternative information. We need to support independent media like Democracy Now!, alternative radio, and South End Press. But the battle to reclaim democracy is going to be a difficult one. Our freedoms were not granted us by any government. They were wrested from them by us. And once we surrender them, the battle to retrieve them is called a revolution. It is a battle that must range across continents and countries. It must not acknowledge national boundaries. But if it is to succeed, it has to begin here in America. The only institution more powerful than the US government is American civil society. The rest of us are subjects of slave nations. We are by no means powerless, but you have the power of proximity. You have access to the imperial palace and the emperor's chambers. Empire's conquests are being carried out in your name, and you have the right to refuse. You could refuse to fight, refuse to move those missiles from the warehouse to the dock, refuse to wave that flag, refuse the victory parade. You have a rich tradition of resistance. You need only read Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States to remind yourself of this. Hundreds of thousands of you have survived the relentless propaganda you've been subjected to and are actively fighting your own government. In the ultra-patriotic climate that prevails in the United States, that's as brave as any Iraqi or Afghan or Palestinian fighting for his or her homeland. If you join the battle, not in your hundreds of thousands, but in your millions, you will be greeted joyously by the rest of the world. And you will see how beautiful it is to be gentle instead of brutal, safe instead of scared, befriended instead of isolated, loved instead of hated. I hate to disagree with your president, but yours is by no means a great nation, but you could be a great people. History is giving you the chance. Seize the time.